In the early phases of the Roman state, moreover, the plebeians were not only excluded from public office, but from intermarriage with the patrician class. The administration was evidently primarily a patrician affair. The early phase of Roman affairs was therefore an aristocracy of a very pronounced type, and the internal history of Rome for the 2½ centuries between the expulsion of the last Etruscan king, Tarquin the Proud, and the beginning of the First Punic War in 264 BC, was very largely a struggle for mastery between these two orders, the patricians and the plebeians. It was, in fact, closely parallel with the struggle of aristocracy and democracy in the city-states of Greece. And, as in the case of Greece, there were whole classes in the community, slaves, freed slaves, unpropertied free men, outlanders, and the like, who were entirely outside and beneath the struggle. We've already noted the essential difference of Greek democracy and what's called democracy in the world today. Another misused word is the Roman term proletariat, which in modern jargon means all the unpropertied people in a modern state. In Rome, the proletarii were a voting division of fully qualified citizens whose property was less than 10,000 copper asses, that's to say £275. They were an enrolled class. Their value to the state consisted in their raising families of citizens, proles, that's to say offspring, and from their ranks were drawn the colonists, who went to form new Latin cities or to garrison important points. But the proletarii were quite distinct in origin from slaves or freedmen or the miscellaneous driftage of a town slum, and it's a great pity that modern political discussion should be confused by an inaccurate use of a term which has no exact modern equivalent and which expresses nothing real in modern social classification. The mass of the details of this struggle between patricians and plebeians we can afford to ignore in this outline. It was a struggle which showed the Romans to be a people of a curiously shrewd character, never forcing things to a destructive crisis, but being within the limits of their discretion, grasping hard dealers. The patricians made a mean use of their political advantages to grow rich through the national conquests at the expense not only of the defeated enemy, but of the poorer plebeian, whose farm had been neglected and who had fallen into debt during his military service. The plebeians were ousted from any share in the conquered lands, which the patricians divided up among themselves. The introduction of money probably increased the facilities of the usurer and the difficulties of the borrowing debtor. Three sorts of pressure won the plebeians a greater share in the government of the country and the good things that were coming to Rome as she grew powerful. The first of these was the general strike of plebeians. Twice they actually marched right out of Rome, threatening to make a new city higher up the Tiber, and twice this threat proved conclusive. The second method of pressure was the threat of a tyranny, just as in Attica, the little state of which Athens was the capital. Pisistratus raised himself to power on the support of the poorer district, so there was to be found in most periods of plebeian discontent some ambitious man ready to figure as a leader and wrest power from the Senate. For a long time, the Roman patricians were clever enough to beat every such potential tyrant by giving in to a certain extent to the plebeians. And finally, there were patricians big-minded and far-seeing enough to insist upon the need of reconciliation with the plebeians. Thus, in 509 BC, Valerius Poplicola, the consul, enacted that whenever the life or rights of any citizen were at stake, there should be an appeal from the magistrates to the general assembly. This Lex Valeria was the habeas corpus of Rome, and it freed the Roman plebeians from the worst dangers of class vindictiveness in the law courts. In 494 BC occurred a strike. After the Latin War, the pressure of debt had become excessive, and the plebeians saw with indignation their friends, who had often served the state bravely in the legions, thrown into chains and reduced to slavery at the demand of patrician creditors. War was raging against the Volscians, but the legionaries, on their victorious return, refused any longer to obey the consuls and marched, though without any disorder, to the sacred mount beyond the Anio up the Tiber. There they prepared to found a new city, since the rights of citizens were denied to them in the old one. The patricians were compelled to give way, and the plebeians, returning to Rome from the first secession, received the privilege of having officers of their own, tribunes, and aediles. In 486 BC arose Spurius Cassius, a consul who carried an agrarian law securing public land for the plebeians. But the next year he was accused of aiming at royal power and condemned to death. His law never came into operation. There followed a long struggle on the part of the plebeians to have the laws of Rome written down so that they would no longer have to trust to patrician memories. In 451 to 450 BC, the Law of the Twelve Tables was published, the basis of all Roman law. But in order that the Twelve Tables should be formulated, a committee of 10, the Decemvirate, was appointed in the place of the ordinary magistrates. A second Decemvirate, appointed in succession to the first, attempted a sort of aristocratic counter-revolution under Appius Claudius. The plebeians withdrew again, a second time, to the sacred mount, and Appius Claudius committed suicide in prison. In 440 came a famine, and a second attempt to found a popular tyranny upon the popular wrongs by Spurius Maelius, a wealthy plebeian, which ended in his assassination. After the sack of Rome by the Gauls in 390 BC, Marcus Manlius, who had been in command of the capital when the Geese had saved it, came forward as a popular leader. The plebeians were suffering severely from the after-war usury and profiteering of the patricians, and were incurring heavy debts in rebuilding and restocking their farms. Manlius spent his fortune in releasing debtors. He was accused by the patricians of tyrannous intentions, condemned, and suffered the fate of condemned traitors in Rome, being flung from the Tarpeian Rock, the precipitous edge of that same Capitoline hill he had defended. In 376 BC, Licinius, who was one of the 10 tribunes for the people, began a long struggle with the patricians by making certain proposals called the Licinian Rogations, that there should be a limit to the amount of public land taken by any single citizen, so leaving some for everybody, that outstanding debts should be forgiven without interest upon the repayment of the principal, and that henceforth one at least of the two consuls should be a plebeian. This precipitated a 10-year struggle. The plebeian power to stop business by the veto of their representatives, the tribunes, was fully exercised. In cases of national extremity, it was the custom to set all other magistrates aside and appoint one leader, the dictator. Rome had done such a thing during times of military necessity before, but now the patricians set up a dictator in a time of profound peace, with the idea of crushing Licinius altogether. They appointed Camillus, who had besieged and taken Veii from the Etruscans. But Camillus was a wiser man than his supporters. He brought about a compromise between the two orders, in which most of the demands of the plebeians were conceded in 366 BC, dedicated a temple to Concord, and resigned his power. Thereafter, the struggle between the orders abated. It abated because, among other influences, the social differences between patricians and plebeians were diminishing. Trade was coming to Rome with increasing political power, and many plebeians were growing rich, and many patricians becoming relatively poor. Intermarriage had been rendered possible by a change in the law, and social intermixture was going on. While the rich plebeians were becoming, if not aristocratic, at least oligarchic in habits and sympathy, new classes were springing up in Rome with fresh interests and no political standing. Particularly abundant were the freedmen, slaves set free, for the most part artisans, but some of them traders, who were growing wealthy. And the Senate, no longer a purely patrician body, since various official positions were now open to plebeians, and such plebeian officials became senators, was becoming now an assembly of all the wealthy, able, energetic, and influential men in the state. The Roman power was expanding, and as it expanded, these old class oppositions of the early Latin community were becoming unmeaning. They were being replaced by new associations and new antagonisms. Rich men of all origins were being drawn together into a common interest against the communistic ideas of the poor. In 390 BC, Rome was a miserable little city on the borders of Etruria, being sacked by the Gauls. In 275 BC, she was ruling and unifying all Italy, from the Arno to the Straits of Messina. The Compromise of Camillus, 367 BC, had put an end to internal dissensions and left her energies free for expansion.